Word of mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Being able to assess what something should cost is a valuable skill. Real estate appraisers evaluate land and property to make sure no one gets burned. Athletic scouts can calculate the worth of amateur athletes, beating others to the punch. And then there is that passionate breed which can appraise rare, collectible items. Ken Gloss is a lion among the latter. He's proprietor of the Brattle Bookshop in Boston, one of the largest and oldest antiquarian bookshops in the country, and an appraiser of rare books and manuscripts for the Antiques Roadshow since 1998. He's with us to kick off our series, Good Gig. Ken, a hearty welcome to Word of Mouth.
Well, thank you very much. Happy to be here.
You brought in so many fantastic-looking rare books. Let's take just a look. What do we begin with?
Well, I would say one of the things that if you want to start off with a newspaper, it's from April 15th, 1865.
Ooh.
Look at the front page, see all the ads, open it up, and by the way, President Lincoln was assassinated. But it's not the headline in the paper. But, you know, this is the way somebody in Providence, Rhode Island might have first seen that President Lincoln was assassinated.
If he got to the second page.
If he got to the second page, past the ads.
It is amazing, and it's so hardy, this paper stock. How much is this worth?
Well, that's worth about $250, $350. The thing is, paper from the Revolutionary War, the Civil War, was actually high-quality paper. Around the 1880s, 90s, it became more wood pulp. And, of course, if you have a modern newspaper from the 1930s, 1940s, they'll crumble in your hand. But if they use this quality paper now, your newspaper would be totally unaffordable. So it's a trade-off.
Ken, just opening it up and fluttering it around, I realize that this is a sound we're hearing less and less, the sound of a newspaper opening up. Probably same for books.
Same for books to a degree. I think people still like books, still read them. What we're losing, and it's not necessarily a terrible thing, is reference in particular. Nobody buys an encyclopedia anymore.
Right.
Very few people buy dictionaries. I think the rare books are going to be the rare books and going to be valuable. I think the bestsellers probably never were and probably never will be. But I'll tell you one great advantage is you can be in Africa in the middle of nowhere. If you can get an internet connection nowadays, you can access all the world's knowledge very cheaply and freely. So for society, that's great. For used bookstores, maybe.
Mm.
But I'm not too worried. I think I'll be able to do this as long as I want.
Well, I'm looking at some other ones in front of you. It looks like you've got a cookbook of some type.
I have the Woman's Suffrage Cookbook. I mean, you know, when you have charity cookbooks and so on, they've had them for years to come. This is from the late 1880s. People collect things on women's suffrage. This is probably a $500, maybe even $1,000 book. It's a very specialized area. But the people who are interested are really interested.
Okay. So is that book from your personal collection or is it available at your bookstore?
It's available at the bookstore.
Is that a fuzzy line there, Ken?
There's not a big fuzzy line. I'll tell you, most of the things that I get in the store, it's a business. So I buy and sell, and it's always what's coming in next. One time my daughter said to me when she was in high school, she said, "All the great things, don't you wish you still had them?" And I looked at her and said, "Yeah, so I could sell them again." But, I mean, you know, when you're dealing with holding letters of Jefferson, Washington, Lincoln, and you're touching them and you know that Thomas Jefferson held this item and touched it. We one time got a letter in, and it was a letter, and Thomas Jefferson was talking about what to do about traitors and terrorists.
Wow.
This was just after the 9/11. He was talking about the War of 1812,
mm-hmm.
and what he said was they should get the full protection of the law and nothing else. And
wow.
You could have just applied that.
To the Patriot Act that was going on then.
Exactly. But, you know, actually sitting there, touching, holding that item, it still thrills me. But I don't keep large collections myself.
Well, that's a question. I mean, I've heard there are two types of collectors. There are those who advocate for, you know, enjoying the items, holding them in their hands, as you're saying, or those who you do put the white gloves on everything and store them away, unseen, and they're considered financial investments. What is it to you?
Well, a lot of people, it's collecting. For me, like I say, it's my business in doing this, but I get the great thrill of holding it or getting it to the right library,
or
the right
reading.
Person.
Do you read them?
Well, I read some of them. If books and publishers had to depend on everybody reading every book they had before they bought the next one, we'd all go out of business. There's always that one on the shelf or the pile by the bed that you want to read. But I'll tell you, there's a middle ground between what you just said. I have friends, collectors, people who will buy two copies.
Wow.
Of everything. One, the rare copy they put behind the glass. Number two, the one they read. So there's the middle ground, too.
What are you looking for when you're appraising a book, given that rarity is just one factor in the value?
Well, usually what you're looking for is, well, first of all, what's the title? Mm-hmm. Who's the author? What's the book about? But then you start looking, is it an early edition? Is it a first edition? What's the condition of the book? Is it signed by someone significant, the author, the publisher, someone famous who owned it? And all of this you do very, very quickly. And then you come up with a general idea of price, or there's no way any one person can know everything there is to know about books. But the key is that you have to know where to ask or who to ask or where to look things up. So part of it is the quick look is, oh, yeah, I know what this is, or this needs more work. I've got to spend some time on it.
Now, you've been working as an appraiser on Antiques Roadshow for some time now, since 98. One of the reasons I think that that show is so compelling is seeing the genuine reactions that we get to hear from people having their goods appraised. Now, here's an example. A woman who spoke with you. Now, you told her that two letters sent to her aunt, Bernice, by Sigmund Freud and Carl Jung were worth somewhere between $15,000 and $20,000. Let's hear.
And they were just, they were up. She was cleaning it out. They were inside a book. They fell out of the book. She came to the show. You know, obviously she knew they had some value, but she wasn't quite expecting what she got.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, my goodness. Oh, my, that's wonderful. I think I'm going to have to preserve these a little bit better than just leaving them folded in the envelopes.
Isn't that everyone's fantasy, that they have something fantastically valuable? So what does it feel like for you when you tell people their goods are indeed valuable or, in some cases, worthless?
Well, of course, you always like to be able to tell somebody that it's valuable. One of the things that I tell people is sometimes people present a book for me to look at and they go, you know, we really don't think this is valuable. And I have to say to them, you know, I hate to agree with you. But many people, what you don't realize when you do a lot of this appraising, many people are absolutely thrilled mm-hmm. when I tell them a book is not valuable.
Really?
Well,
the pressure's off?
The pressure's off. They don't have to take care of it. Many, many cases, if it's a children book, they want to give it to their grandchildren. If you say it's worth $200 or $300, it doesn't change anybody's life. If you say it's worth $20,000 or $30,000, well, that's a whole different reaction. I had a lady at one of my talks, and she had a whole box of papers, and they were nice. They'd been up in the attic, and we're lifting through them, and then we hit one, and it says, A Declaration of Independence.
What?
It wasn't the first edition. It was about a week later. It was worth $750,000.
Oh, my goodness.
And my guess is she lived in an old house that probably had been in the attic since 1776. But needless to say, she was happy.
Wow. You must have seen a lot of really valuable pieces like that come through your bookstore and through your appraisals and your shows.
It's some of the things that I just feel fortunate. Not everything that I've owned. I got called by a museum just to do an appraisal. And I saw what they wanted me to look at. I said, look, I do a lot of favors for them, the great museum. I'll do it for free, but I don't want to do it from your website, from anything. I want to
touch it.
Yeah. Anyways, a 4-page handwritten letter of Paul Revere's ride by Paul Revere.
Oh, my goodness.
So I'm sitting there holding a 4-page account of Paul Revere's ride done a week after the ride and him describing in detail what happened. And this is Paul Revere's.
So, Ken, is that the thrill of the chase for you? I mean, I'm sure you have days that are a little more mundane than that.
Yeah. Although, in many cases, we go to somebody's house. We go up to the 5th floor walk-up. They have 2,000 general used books. It's 95 degrees out. You get a great workout. But that's the part of the business that a lot of people don't realize. But that's as important as sometimes the very rare and esoteric and fun things.
Well, I'm going to play another clip. In 2012, sure. You appraised a first edition of Cormac McCarthy's book, The Orchard Keeper, told the owner that at first glance, might have been valued at about $3,500, but then you notice something. Let's hear the clip.
One of the things that you run into nowadays is where the dust jacket is 90% of the value. There are many people who copy a dust jacket. They can do it incredibly well nowadays.
Okay.
So the book, as it is, with a dust jacket that's not right, is worth retail $100 or so.
And it was originally worth $5. It was free to me. So if it's a $100 book, it's a $100 book.
Well, he's pretty good-spirited about it. But this is kind of an odd case. But over the course of your career, especially now that printing and design techniques are so sophisticated, have you seen a lot of these so-called rare books that are fakes?
You don't see many rare books that are fakes because to fake a rare book is a huge job and actually could be more expensive than the rare book would be. Mm. What you do see is fakes of the inscriptions, signatures. One of the things, though, that does happen is the paper dust jacket on a book can be in way, way more valuable. Like that clip, if you have The Great Gatsby, you have a nice first edition without the dust jacket, it's worth a few $1,000s. With the jacket, it might be worth a few $100,000.
Wow.
You got to watch out for that once in a while, but it's still the signatures, the inscriptions that we watch for more.
You know what collectors want. Have you ever made a terrible bet on and put out a lot of money on something that didn't sell?
Well, what I always tell people, if you're either a collector, in the business, whatever, the biggest mistake you can ever make is not ever making a mistake. Because if you don't make a mistake, it means you're being so conservative and passing up lots and lots of good things. Of course, you can't help but make mistakes. Sometimes I've bought books, paid a good price, and hadn't checked them closely enough and realized that maybe there's a few pages missing, which have brought them down to nothing. And then once in a while, I've missed on a signature, and you have to. You can't do it. But again, the biggest mistake is not taking chances. And a lot of times, those chances you have to do either at an auction or from another person, just have to do it on right then and there,
yeah.
And there's no time to do the research. So you take a chance.
You got to know what you're doing. Well, old books are not always valued just for their contents or their rarity. Sometimes as aesthetic objects. I noticed on your website that it's specifically for decorators. So do a lot of people come in and say, I don't necessarily want to read or collect books, but I want books that are going to look good on a shelf?
Well, first of all, when you talk about decorators, a lot of movies come in,
right.
And advertising sets. We've had a few recently. We one time had, and this was one of the stranger orders, someone ordered 6,000 red books. They had to be some shade of red. Now it's.
And did you have them?
Yeah, we got them. But it actually made more sense. It was for Ann Taylor, and they had a red dress. They wanted 100 books in the display. They had 60 stores. 6,000 red books.
Wow.
But yeah, there are people who just, they want their living room or library to look intelligent. They have no care or clue, whatever. They just want to fill up the shelves. On the other hand, there are beautifully done, beautifully illustrated covers and designs. And graphically, those can be really, really beautiful. And so people are collecting the design of the book as art, and that's a whole different type as opposed to, just fill the shelves up.
Now, Ken Gloss, your family has been doing this for a couple of generations now. Had you not been born into this, what do you think you would be doing, or can you imagine yourself doing anything else?
Well, I have a degree in chemistry from
University. No kidding.
I was going to get a doctoral in Wisconsin, and in 1973, my father wasn't well. I had worked at the store all through my younger years. Not necessarily by choice, mm-hmm. But it was a family business. And he wasn't feeling that well. I needed a year off. That year now has been about 40 years. and tell you the truth, I don't regret not being in a laboratory somewhere. I mean, this is like a treasure hunt. It's like being Jim Hawkins almost every day, not knowing where you're going to go, who you're going to meet. It's really a lot of it. It's the people and the houses. And, of course, you want to find good books and so on.
Ken Gloss, proprietor of the Brattle Bookshop in Boston. What a pleasure speaking with you.
Thank you.
Ken's also an appraiser for the Antiques Roadshow, and there's much more on his bookstore and his many public speaking events at wordofmouthradio.org. Have you got a good gig? Well, we're looking for guests for our series, so if you love your job, we'd like to know about it, especially if it's a job few people do or think of as work. You can go to our Facebook page and tell us about what you do, or send a brief email to wordofmouth@nhpr.org and put good gig in the subject line. That's wordofmouth@nhpr.org with good gig in the subject line. And with that, we are out of time, and thank you for listening to our gig for today. There's much more at wordofmouthradio.org. You can also follow us. You can send us your feedback or share your ideas for the program on Facebook and on Twitter. We find some of the most fascinating stories through word of mouth. Let's hear yours. I'm Virginia Prescott. We'll be back with more Word of Mouth tomorrow at 2 on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by
Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its board of trustees,
or its underwriters. Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.